Hello listeners and welcome to Sports Bill. We're a week late, as you may have noticed, but we're back with a bang for episode 4. Joining me, Alistair Hooper, is a man who hopefully shares the same opinion as me that this double act will one day supplant the Chuckle Brothers in the hearts of the nation. It's Mr. Will Moulton.
Hello. I wasn't expecting that introduction at all.
I didn't think
it was. Had you planned that? Or was that off the cuff?
I wrote it today.
Fair enough. No, it's good to be back. Yeah, apologies, we're a bit late. Just unforeseen circumstances, unfortunately. But yeah, we're back. We've got a fantastic interview. We've got some great topics to discuss. I'm looking forward to episode 4.
Yes, and I suppose before we get cracking, we should probably set the scene. As you do on radio, we're out of the studio, we're on our travels, and as a motorbike conveniently goes by, we're sitting outside TalkSport at the moment in this little green bit, and there are two five-a-side pitches right next to us, so you might hear the odd football thudding, and hopefully it won't actually hit either of us.
But hopefully not like the first episode. Hopefully we won't have any kids on bikes running up and down shouting strange words.
Don't hold your breath. But anyway, coming up on the first section of this episode of Sports Spiel, we're going to go through the sporting stories from the last 3 weeks, because we have a lot more time to catch up on. First off, we're going to talk about the Indy 500 and Fernando Alonso and his performance after his break from Formula One in the Monaco Grand Prix. Then we'll talk about Tiger Woods, who's found himself in a spot of bother recently. Next up, it's Arsene Wenger and his new contract at Arsenal, followed by the Champions League final, with Real Madrid coming out on top once again. After that, we're going to talk hockey. It was the Women's Euro Hockey Champions Cup and the Men's Euro Hockey League. I got that right, didn't I?
Almost.
So close. But then lastly, we're going to have a little bit of fun and talk about what we think might be the funniest / most inappropriate names in sport. In our second segment in this episode, our feature interview section, Will spoke to Welsh hockey international Beth Bingham about earning 50 caps and her unconventional start in the sport. All that and more on Sportsbill. Well, first up on our topic of discussion today is Fernando Alonso and the Indy 500. Now, McLaren driver Alonso skipped the Monaco Grand Prix to compete in the iconic Indy 500, part of his bid for the triple motorsport crown, which is Monaco, the Indy 500, and the Le Mans. It was an impressive debut for Alonso, but something he's quite used to at the moment, his engine failed on lap 179 of 200. In the end, it was Takuma Sato who won the race, but up until lap 179, Alonso did quite well, didn't he?
Yeah, he was in the lead early on in the race. So I think he was 7th or 8th at the time, challenging near the top of the leaderboard. And again, as they have in Formula 1, McLaren have built a really good chassis. And in Alonso, I believe they have the best circuit driver in the world. And it was no surprise it was up at the top. And then it was also no surprise that his engine failed. I'm just impressed that it lasts so long almost. Honda are in a mess at the moment, but it was fantastic that the Indy 500, which is a great event, a lot of people moan about American racing, the IndyCar series, it's just driving around an oval, but actually the IndyCar series isn't. IndyCar is a lot of street circuits and track racing, and it's quite an interesting spectacle. The Indy 500 is, yes, just round and round in a bit of a circle, but the Indy 500 series is a great one, and it was just so nice to see. I saw a stat on Twitter that the coverage alone in the UK on social media and stuff like that went up by 950% just because Alonso was taking part. And it's a great... I watched, there was an IndyCar series race on the other day, same time as the Champions League final, actually, and I was just flicking between the two, and it was a great race, a great event. And yeah, it was an interesting... I haven't seen all of it, I've only seen the highlights, but it was a very interesting race. And it was good to see Takuma Sato win. He's a driver that took a lot of stick during his career for some of his ridiculous attempts at overtaking, of course a lot of crashes, and people say he's a dangerous driver and he shouldn't be driving, but he's got some talent, and finally he's been able to prove that, and winning the Indy 500 is a fantastic achievement.
Yeah, absolutely drummed up a lot of support and attention in this country having Alonso in it for the first time. And I watched the second half of the race, and I'd never watched an IndyCar race before, so I was just in time to see Alonso go out. But another sort of flashpoint of that race was the massive crash that happened, and it's really a miracle that they actually walked out of that.
Yeah, so for those of you who didn't see, the crash was between Scott Dixon, who was on pole for the race, and Jay Howard, who is an English driver. So Howard was being lapped, and he ends up going up to the top of the track, and he ends up going on what's called the marbles. So it's all the bits of rubber that have flown off, and they're not on the racing lines. It's really slippy. He's being lapped, so he's forced up there. He wasn't happy that he was forced up there. He ends up colliding the wall and comes back down across the track. He's just missed by Tony Kanaan, who is a legendary racer himself. But he goes straight into the path of Scott Dixon, launches Dixon in the air, who he corkscrews in the air, lands on his side on top of a wall, like a concrete wall. And they both walk out fine. There are no serious injuries, a few bruises. The safety in motorsport, it's always been a big talking point. But the fact that cars can survive this, the safety cell, the actual cell surrounding the driver, was completely intact after that enormous crash. It's unbelievable the amount of work and technology now that's in, it's in Indy cars, Formula One cars, any type of car, that makes them so safe. And it was very, very nice to see him walk away. But I also wasn't surprised, because we've seen Mark Webber's crash in 2010 in Valencia. We saw Robert Kubica crash 2007 Montreal, where he just decimates the car, but the safety cell was still together and helped him survive that enormous crash with nothing more than a few broken ribs maybe and a sore back. So it's just fantastic to see. But it was a scary moment.
Yeah, definitely, scary. Definitely. But safety certainly has gone up another level. Mm-hmm. But we'll go to the race that Alonso skipped in favour of the Indy 500. That was, of course, Monaco.
That was a dull race, wasn't it? The problem with the new cars this year is they're wider. They're quicker, but they're wider, and they're more difficult to follow. So overtaking at Monaco is already hard. But this time round, it was not impossible. I don't think there were any overtakes, really, in the race.
There were a couple, but...
And the one time Jenson Button tried, and Pascal Wehrlein on his side.
Exactly, that's what I was going to turn on to. Quite a spectacular misjudgment from Button there in his first race back after retirement, taking Alonso's seat. He also kindly said he'd pee in the seat while Alonso was off on his travels. But I suppose in terms of the result, the main talking point was Mercedes. Certainly seem to be the underdogs now to Ferrari.
The car wasn't suited to that track for whatever reason. I don't know if it was the engine or if it's something in the design, but the Ferrari was set up beautifully the whole weekend. I felt bad for Raikkonen. People were debating whether or not it's team orders. I think Ferrari knew that Vettel would get the overcut.
Oh, they knew.
Red Bull maybe not, because they had the overcut with Ricciardo. I don't think they knew, but I reckon Ferrari must have known. And fair play to Kimi, he kept his mouth shut at the end. He didn't say anything. But Kimi was quick the whole weekend. He never really let Vettel get away from him in the race. He, apart from the moments where he gave up, once he'd been passed by Vettel, he did give up, because he knew he wasn't going to get that place back. But going back to Button as well, I wax lyric about Alonso all the time, because I think he's a fantastic driver. And again, that was proved when he came on the radio. He phoned Button from America to speak to him before the race and wish him luck. I really, really enjoyed that moment. It was so nice, because so often Formula One drivers are criticised and moaned at for not having personalities. Alonso and Button are two that have always had personality. Alonso, especially in the last couple of years, has not been afraid to say what he thinks. And it was a really touching moment, and I just want to see more of that in the sport. I want the drivers to seem more human again, because at the moment they're a little bit robotic, a little bit difficult to listen to. So that was really nice to see, and hopefully Alonso sticks around next year.
It was a nice moment, that. But of course, in terms of Drivers' Championship, that leaves Vettel on 129 points and Hamilton on 104 points. Constructors' title, Ferrari on 196 and Mercedes on 179. Bit of catching up to do, but still a long way to go.
Yeah, there's a long way to go. I reckon it'll go down to the final race this year. I don't know who between, because Bottas and Raikkonen could well come back into it, but we'll see. It's going to be a good season, I think.
Exactly. Which is what we all really wanted, finally. And we'll move on to topic number two of the episode, which is Tiger Woods, something most people will probably have seen on the news in the last few weeks. He was found asleep at his wheel at 3 a.m. in the morning and was arrested and charged with driving under the influence. But, of course, Tiger Woods says that alcohol wasn't involved, and he blamed it on an unexpected reaction to prescribed medication. I think toxicology and blood alcohol tests have found that there wasn't any alcohol in his system. But the video, he's swaying, and his mugshot doesn't look good, and it's another episode in sort of the sad decline of a once great sportsman.
Yeah, people have their views on Tiger Woods. A lot of people, even when he was good, didn't like him because of his attitude. But it's always sad to see someone as great as him, who was almost overnight, turn from this legend into this... he's almost a joke now. Mm. It was pretty much as soon as he was found guilty of having all the affairs and stuff and drove into the fire hydrant, it was like a veil was lifted, and he went from this untouchable, godlike golfer to this has been really. He's had so many injury problems since. He's never played good golf since.
Exactly. I mean, before the fire hydrant incident, he had 18 major championships, which is just five away from Jack Nicklaus's record, and he looked like he was going to go on and pass that by miles, really. And of course, 2009 is when he smashed into that fire hydrant in his car on Thanksgiving, and it's just never really been the same since then. But I suppose, really, where does he go from here? Because I think he has two challenges to face up to in the coming months and years. Firstly, return to fitness, which he might do. I know it's going to be a heck of a challenge for him, but secondly, which I don't think he really has much of a chance of now, is to repair his public image.
I think, yeah, they're massive challenges, but I think this sting, it doesn't stick, this just smacks of a cry for help. I think he needs to sort himself out. He's clearly all is not well for whatever reason, and I think this is a cry for help, and hopefully I just hope it kickstarts something to get him back. Because, I mean, I was never a massive fan of Tiger Woods as a player, but you don't ever want to see someone suffer. And, I think that big challenge is for him is to mentally and physically get back to as good as he can be, to somewhere. He's never going to be as good as he once was when he was younger, because you can't be. But he just needs, hopefully now this will kickstart a change in his life, and he'll get the help he needs to help him function properly again.
It would. I mean, it's going to be a lot of work he's got to put in if he's ever going to reach those same impeccable levels that he was once playing at. Because it's been 8 years now.
It's a long time.
Which is a long time. He's been through a lot in that time. But we'll move away from Tiger Woods to the other big talking point that sort of dominated for the last few months in terms of sports news. Arsene Wenger. Long-serving Arsenal manager.
To continue to be long-serving as well.
To continue. Well, would he sign? Would he not sign? Of course he did sign. A new 2-year contract, despite Arsenal finishing fifth, which is the first time they will be outside of the Champions League with Wenger as manager. Mm. But of course they did win the FA Cup, which was nice. Now, we had Tony Adams in TalkSport. Last week, I think it was.
Plug in the fact you were now working for TalkSport, are you, mate?
I thought I'd get that in without anyone noticing, but whatever. He was also plugging his new book, which is part of the reason why he was in. But last week, he also said that he prayed Arsene Wenger would quit after the FA Cup final, which is a quite damning statement from Mr. Arsenal himself, captain throughout three decades of that club. Should he have stayed, or should he have gone?
My personal opinion, and obviously I don't really know anything about anything, but I would have liked him to have gone, because he would have finished on that high of an FA Cup win. And also, I wanted his legacy still to be, well, not a legacy, but I wanted the fans to have positive images of him, because he's done so many good things with that club in the 21 years he's been there. But I think if he sticks around for another two seasons, like you see, and it's not real journalism, but Arsenal fan TV, and like you got the flags and the plane saying Wenger, like Wenger has done some great things for Arsenal, and that's what he should be remembered for, not for the fans wanting to kick him out. And I think an FA Cup win would have been the perfect thing to have gone out on. It's his seventh FA Cup win. He's won more than any other manager as far as I'm aware, beating Chelsea as well. He's beaten Mourinho this season for the first time in his career. He's done some good things this year, and again, Arsenal had a fantastic end to the season. They've ended on a high. I think he should have gone just for his own reputation.
Part of me says yes, but I suppose 2 years, what if he does win the league? a lot of talk is now that they're out of the Champions League, we've seen the last two Premier League winners win because they don't have Champions League demands.
But is he going to have his two star players there next season?
Ooh, that's another question.
Sanchez and Isla, are they going to be there? That is...
I think no.
I think one of them will leave, for definite.
My money's on Sanchez if we had to pick one. Also, you mentioned Arsenal Fan TV. Fun little fact, Arsenal Fan TV now has an Arsenal Fan TV football club. So we were thinking, what if Arsenal Fan TV football club has Arsenal Fan TV football club fan TV?
Oh, God. A never-ending cycle.
Oh, it's never-ending.
No, thanks.
But anyway, I've diverged slightly.
Yes, just a little
what
bit.
What does Arsene need to do now if he is going to reclaim some success and some pride, really? He brought in a new signing in the form of Sead Kolasinac. We now know that's definitely how you say his name. A left back from Schalke. He's arrived on a free transfer. Good signing. What else does he need to do?
I don't really know a lot about this new player, to be honest. I've seen on Facebook BT shared a video of him scoring a goal. So that's all
always
I know.
Nice.
That's all
always
I know
nice.
Of him. But it's a good signing to get someone from Schalke on a free. And as someone who's got international experience, I think that's a good move. He's been linked with Mbappe, hasn't he? But I think
that's not happening.
The papers are saying today that he's lost that race. Yeah, if he's going to lose Sanchez and Ozil, he needs a playmaker, and he needs an out and out, not an out and out striker, but he needs like another Sanchez. He needs a replacement of Sanchez, because Sanchez at times was carrying that club. I mean, he's a bit of a selfish player, but he probably needs to shore up his defence a little bit as well.
I think that's the main thing, is the defence. If he can keep Sanchez and Ozil, I think he's okay in terms of attack. I think he needs another workaholic alongside Sanchez, but I think he already has that, Danny Welbeck.
Yeah.
It's just about keeping Danny Welbeck fit now, but he definitely needs to shore up that defence, because that's been their Achilles heel for a long, long time now. Which is why I also think the 3-4-3 system that he's sort of changed to recently could actually serve him quite well.
As the rain starts to fall.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it was on the defensive note, though, I did like the fact he played Rob Holding at the end of the year, and Rob Holding did okay, actually. So there's an interesting young prospect to come through, and next year he needs to be challenging for the title up until pretty much the end of the season. Even if he doesn't win, if he comes top two or top three, if all three are challenging to the end of the season, that's what he needs to do. Get back in the Champions League, and then he needs to actually prove in the Champions League that he can get anywhere, because so many times they've gone out in the last 16. They need to not draw Bayern Munich as well, because they're going to lose. But yeah, we'll see.
Yes.
I'm looking forward to next season already, but I'm also enjoying the break from football at the moment. It's a nice focus on other sports.
Exactly. But speaking of Champions League, we will discuss Champions League in a moment, because the rain is starting to come down now. So we'll take a little break, have our next little jingle, while we work out what the hell we're going to do. See you in a moment. Hey, we're back. The rain's stopped a bit, and we found a tree to hide under. Wow, what a noise to come out of a human. That's staying in.
I'm so sorry. Oh dear.
Seamless broadcasting, everyone. We're professionals.
We might want to do that again.
Never. Champions League. Let's chat Champions League. What happened? Real Madrid, that's what happened. They beat Juventus 4-1 to claim their 12th European Cup. That was on Saturday in Cardiff. Now, people are saying that this current Real Madrid squad are possibly the best club at the moment. Possibly the best club ever. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, I think they're the best side in the world at the moment. Three of the last four Champions Leagues, they're just unstoppable, especially in that competition. Best side ever? Don't think so. I'm trying to think of a team who I think would be better. But
a lot of people are comparing them to Pep's Barcelona team. Personally, I liked Guardiola's Barcelona. I thought they were probably a little bit better in the way they went about things. But
even if you compare them to the Real Madrid, the Galacticos, or even going back to the 50s and 60s with Puskas in the squads and Di Stefano, Yeah, I don't know if they're necessarily the best team ever, but they're certainly the best side around at the moment. And they play some really attractive football. They were good to watch in the final. The way they unpicked that Juventus defence as well was actually quite... I found it quite intelligent to watch. And yeah, and Ronaldo getting two goals as ever, the top scorer in the tournament.
Ronaldo. But something I want to mention is Zidane, Real's manager. Obviously a great player, but he's turning out into quite a great manager, and I think he was severely underrated through the season. He was given a fair bit of bad press, I think, for the way he was managing the side. But he has now managed Real Madrid in 20 Champions League games and already won it twice. He's now won it more times as a manager than he did as a player. Fun little fact. And I think it's probably about time that Zidane gets as much credit for the job he's doing as a manager as he deserves.
I think the issue people have with Zidane is that he's inherited what was already a very, very strong Real Madrid side, and he's not yet proven that he could take a not-so-good side and do such good things with them. I think that's the issue people are having. That's the issue I'm sort of having around Zidane as well.
I think, considering that dressing room has eaten up a lot of managers, and I think he's been very, very clever in his man management. There's one phrase, I can't remember who said it this week. Zidane has managed to de-galactico the Galacticos. That was the phrase. Clever phrase. But he's made a squad of, quite frankly, quite large egos and individuals into a team. And in my notes, I have capitalised and double underlined this, so it's clearly important, Casemiro. Before Zidane came in, it was Kroos and Modric, all stars. But when Zidane came in, Casemiro started every time. He's the one person you can't take off that team sheet because he gives that team such valuable balance. That says a lot to me about Zidane as the manager and the way he's managed to form the Galacticos into a team.
But it's also, he's also then, by doing that, he's forced Kroos and Modric to adapt their games. And they're still in the starting lineup because they've adapted their games and they've done that successfully. And that's because they have been challenged by Zidane, and that's another impressive thing that he's done that maybe people haven't recognised, that he has adapted players and he's forced them to not do what they were used to, what they're comfortable with. Casemiro, what a turnaround in fortunes he's had in the last couple of years, gone from a bit part player to mainstay in the team.
Scoring in the final.
And he scored an absolute worldie as well, didn't he, in the knockout rounds against Dynamo Moscow, maybe?
Possibly, can't remember. But the goal he scored in the final just thumped it. Great deflection and in, but you earn your own luck.
But also what you said, a team of egos, there still is one big ego.
Who could that be?
That's Ronaldo.
Never.
But it does work having him as the one ego. And he's proving it. He's in his 30s now and he's still scoring a ridiculous amount of goals. 12 goals in the Champions League this season. I've always said Cristiano Ronaldo he's a better player than Messi, not just because of on the field, but also off the field. Messi's got all these issues with tax and stuff like that. He's covered in stupid tattoos and stuff. Whereas Ronaldo, he gives blood, he does all that. I've always had a lot of respect for him. However, he has now got his own tax investigation going on, so I might have to rethink that. But again, in that final, he proved. And he's a big game player as well. He always scores or does something in the big finals. Euro 2016 might be an exception, but he got injured. I reckon if he'd played the full 90 in that game, he would have scored. He's a big game player, and he doesn't shy away from a situation. And he proved that again in the Champions League final with a really, really good performance.
And I've taken a sneaky little peek at your notes in the same way I do when I'm cheating in an exam. And you have Sergio Ramos antics written down.
Yeah.
Oscar surely is in the running for Sergio Ramos in the near future.
It's a dead cert, isn't it? I think that was outrageous. When I saw the incident initially, I didn't even think Cuadrado had touched him. I think, what's he doing on the floor? Yeah, he's inadvertently stamped on his foot, but I know from personal experience, having someone stamp on your foot, it does sting a little bit, but to get him sent off...
He does go down as if he has been shot. By a massive rifle.
It was always going to be one of two things in that Champions League final. Ramos was either going to get sent off himself or was going to get someone else sent off.
He's a great defender, but he always has that real dirty side.
It just lets him down because he's such a good player, but no one's ever going to remember him as a great because there's going to be all this rubbish.
Exactly.
It's like Pepe as well. Great defender as well. He's probably going to be leaving, apparently.
He is leaving,
in the
yes.
summer.
Yep.
Great defender, but again, we'll always remember him for his ridiculous antics and rolling around on the floor.
Exactly. Not going to buy you many fans unless you are just a Real Madrid ultra, I suppose.
Very true.
But we'll move away from the Champions League to another European Champions competition. Nice link there. And it's the world of hockey. Now, it was the Women's Euro Hockey Club Champions Cup. Written it down, nailed it, in Den Bosch between the 2nd and the 5th of June. Surbiton came 4th, Canterbury came 6th, and the Wimbledon men were also in action in the Euro Hockey League and finished 4th. Now, I know nothing about hockey, so this is where I pass over to you, because you, of course, know everything about hockey.
I mean, you say that this time last year I knew nothing about hockey. I've become a little bit obsessed, but I'll try and keep it short. But yeah, basically, Surbiton, this was their third consecutive European tournament. They're obviously nailing the league every single year. They've won it 4 years in a row now. The last 2 years, though, they hadn't got past the first round in the Club Champions Cup. This year was the first time they did that. They beat the Spanish team SV Complutense.
Well pronounced.
In the quarterfinal. I haven't written the score down, which is really, really bad of me. Then in the semi-final, they came up against Den Bosch, who have, before this championship, they'd won 14 out of the 34 Euro hockey titles. They're the one team you don't want to come up against. They won every single title between 2000 and 2011. And up until the 36th minute, Surbiton were well in the game. It was 1-1 in 36 minutes. And then, but they'd been run ragged by Den Bosch. And Den Bosch then just stepped up a gear. Surbiton were tired. And they ended up losing 7-1, but that scoreline doesn't reflect. And I didn't see the whole game, but I've heard and I've watched the highlights. And Surbiton acquitted themselves really, really well. And then in the third, fourth playoff, they lost to another Dutch side, Amsterdam 3-1. But again, I watched most of that game and they acquitted themselves really, really well for most of that. It was 2-1 at half-time. The killer blow came about 90 seconds after half-time. Amsterdam got that third goal. Surbiton hadn't quite switched on. But then after that, the last 10, 15, 20 minutes, really, really impressive. And that's something I noticed from what the commentators and what the media have been saying as well, that Surbiton really, really impressed in the tournament this year with the hockey they were playing. They were saying that Surbiton have stepped up another gear. Yes, they've been dominating England for the last few years, but now they've stepped up that gear and they're now starting to compete with the best teams in the world. Den Bosch are an absolutely outstanding team. But I was to watch them play is a privilege, because the hockey they exhibit is unbelievable, and they went on to win the competition again. But Surbiton, in that first 30, 35, 36 minutes, really, really gave them a good fight. And then they gave Amsterdam a good fight and they beat the Spanish side. There's some real, real talent in that squad. Not just the big names. You've got your Georgie Twiggs. You've got your Giselle Ansleys. You've got some big names in there. But one player I was really impressed with, actually, was Louisa Bray in goal. So she's 18, 19 years old. She's still at school. She's in from Sabi Heesh, who unfortunately tore her ACL. Sabi's in the Great Britain setup. So Louisa and Ellie Sharbo have been stepping in for the latter half of the season. And I watched Louisa Bray. She's pulling off some fantastic saves. Some reaction saves that I didn't think were possible in that third, fourth playoff. She's not the only one. Naomi Evans up front, a really, really good player. Olivia Chilton looks a good player. Emily Atkinson. So many good players on that side, and they're stepping up. Next year, the challenge is, I think, third, or maybe even gets to the final. But a word for Canterbury as well. Canterbury lost in their opening game, but they didn't lose all their games. They then beat a Russian side 3-1 in sort of the crossover. Ended up in the 5th, 6th place playoff. Came up against Complutense as well. Drew 3-3 and lost on 3-2 on penalty strokes. They also had a good tournament. Their squad is not so star-squadded. The only player of real note in there is Grace Ballsden, who's part of the England setup again and the GB setup. Really, really talented defender. Great ball striker as well. Like the speed of her flicks at penalty corners is just something insane. But they've got a really, really... I've watched them play. They've got a really good team ethos. They're a really solid unit. They didn't do quite so well as they normally do in England this year, but no doubt next season they'll be back pushing Surbiton at the top of the league. So yeah, really impressive, and it's just nice to see that the English teams now have started to compete with the Dutch teams, especially in women's hockey, have always been that step above. But now the English sides, the German sides, the Belgian sides, are all just starting to catch up a little bit. So it's exciting to see exciting to see what will happen next year in the Euros, that's for certain.
Exactly. And I know nothing about hockey, but I got to watch Surbiton play and Wimbledon men play, actually, when I went to the league hockey finals with your good self. And even if I know nothing, I can still appreciate that they're a damn good side, Surbiton, to watch.
Another player I didn't mention is actually, she's probably my favourite player to watch, is Hannah Martin. I was working with, as you said, with you at the hockey finals, and I heard another media person say, where has Hannah Martin been hiding all these years? So first year at Surbiton, this year she's been at Ipswich, and she's been at University of Birmingham as well. And from what I'm hearing, her development this year from where she was this time last year, she's just grown so much at Surbiton. She's so exciting to watch. Like, the stuff she does, the stick control, the ball control, is insane. So players like her coming through, coming into the England and GB setup, is so exciting. And defending that Olympic gold going forward to Tokyo now. They've got the two women's internationals coming up this weekend, which I'm working at, which I'm really, really excited for. I reckon they're going to be two really good games, and they're the opportunity for the new players like the Hannah Martins, like the Susie Petties, like the Ellie Reyes, to come through and really show just how good they are and how good the squad is going to be in the next few years.
Exactly. But we'll move on now to our final topic of discussion in the first segment of this episode, and it's the moment where we celebrate the funny names, or the names that could be interpreted as something else in sport. Basically, we're going for rude and crude.
Yeah, bit of schmutz.
Yes. Now, granted, this is not our most intelligent or sophisticated section that we've ever included in the podcast, but it was a good bit of fun, actually, putting these names together.
It was inspired by Daniel Fark being named the new Norwich manager, wasn't it, as well?
Daniel who?
Daniel who, exactly.
Yes. So he's the inspiration for this, and we have a good old list of other people who could possibly take the title of most embarrassing name in sport. So, I don't know, do you want to go first?
Well, the first one I've got listed is actually the name of a stadium. So it's an international cricket stadium in India. It depends on how you pronounce it. Some people pronounce it the Wankhede Stadium. Some people pronounce it the Wankhede Stadium.
Which one's worse?
They're both not great, but yeah, it's spelt almost... The first four letters are spelt how it sounds as well. But no one ever picks up on it in commentary, but perhaps that's because it's the BBC, and the BBC don't do schmuck.
No, we don't like that sort of thing. No. My first one is Thomas Fockett. I haven't gone, subtle here. I've gone straight out.
Yeah, straight in.
He's a Belgian footballer, and he's currently playing for Ghent. And I think he first came to my attention when they were playing in the Europa League. And I went, ha, that'll be good for later. Sure enough, this is the moment in my life that I've been waiting for, that I've been saving up his name. Back to you.
Another not necessarily particularly subtle one is Misty Hyman, the US swimmer who won the 200-meter butterfly at the 2000 Olympics, has taken a lot of stick throughout her career for that name. But she's also, in her own rights, a fantastic swimmer. So I think she pulls it off.
Next up for me, I've got Dick Pound. Why doesn't he just go with Richard? I mean, come on.
Yeah, that's...
Of course, good old Dick is the Canadian lawyer and was the former president of the World Anti-Doping Agency and the vice president of the IOC. But he also was a former swimmer in his youth. And he won a gold, two silvers and one bronze at the 1962 British Empire and Commonwealth Games, as they were called in those days, in Perth. So he has a bit of sporting pedigree as well. But just stick to Richard.
Yeah, probably best. Next up for me is, I don't really know a lot about this individual, but she is a volleyball player. She's represented Japan at a couple of Olympics. Her name is Yoshi Takeshita.
Take a what?
Exactly. That's just such an unfortunate name, but only in Britain, I think, would you find that funny.
Yeah, only for us, I think. Next up, I have the New York Islanders right winger and alternative captain is Cal Clutterbuck. Great name.
Not necessarily smut this time.
Not necessarily smut, but you don't want to be a Clutterbuck, do you?
No, not really.
Unsurprisingly, his wife, Cassie DiPaolo, didn't take his surname when they got married. Also, other little fun fact here, Andrew Lincoln of The Walking Dead and Love Actually, British actor. Real name, Andrew James Clutterbuck.
Really?
I wonder why he went for Andrew Lincoln.
It's just a better stage name, isn't it? Sounds a bit like Abraham Lincoln as well.
Nice.
And then my penultimate choice is Rusty Kuntz. That is how you pronounce it. He is a very famous American baseball player. He played for the Chicago White Sox, the Minnesota Twins, and the Detroit Tigers, and a pretty successful career. Now coaches in baseball, and has kept that name, and is not afraid of it.
My next one, again, I'm going right out there, is Dick Felt. He was an American football defensive back, and he played for the New York Titans and the Boston Patriots. He passed away in 2012, but left a great name for us all to remember. Following that up, I'm also going to throw in Dong Dong, who is a Chinese trampoline gymnast, and you may have remember him even, because he won gold at London 2012.
Did he?
And got the silver medal at Rio. So great name there to flash up on your TV screen,
especially if you're a bloke.
Dong Dong.
And my final name is one made infamous by Mr. Bradley Walsh of The Chase, one of the best TV clips in history. It is, of course, the German alpine skier Fanny Schmeller. She's not particularly big or that well known. She competed in the slalom alpine skiing event at the 2010 Games, but didn't finish her second run. That's pretty much all she's done. She's got a couple of World Cup podiums as well. But she will forever be immortalised because of that name.
For all of us here, what a clip that was on The Chase.
So I think we're going to run a poll on this, aren't we?
I still have two to go.
You still got two to go?
Yes.
I apologise.
My penultimate name, Gaylord Cilley.
Oh, yeah.
We all remember Gaylord Cilley. Long-distance runner representing the Seychelles. Interestingly, he also works as a tree surgeon in France when he's not actually competing. So imagine that, you've booked your tree surgeons to have a little bit of work done in the garden, and Gaylord rocks up at your front door. Perfect.
There'll be some people who'd be offended by that, I think.
Just a bit, I think, that is actually his name. But I'm going to finish with possibly my favourite one, in John Arthur Cox. Now, we see Cox. But John Arthur doesn't go by the name John Arthur. He goes by the name Chubby. So he is Chubby Cox. Chubby was a basketball player. He was drafted by the Chicago Bulls in 1978. He only played at NBA level with the Washington Bullets. But what a name. And he will be forever remembered as Chubby Cox. But we're going to... Yes, as you were saying, we're going to run a poll.
Yes, we are. Sorry, I need to compose myself. We are indeed going to run a poll. So, as the last two weeks, as the last two episodes we've done, the top three names, and then we'll have a choice for other for what you think and let us know. We're looking forward to some of the names you guys come up with. But the names we're going to put up there are Fanny Schmeller, Chubby Cox, and Gaylord Cilley. But feel free to tweet or Facebook and tell us what you think is the most ridiculous, stupid, smutty, innuendo-ridden name in sport.
Yes. Just thinking, what would Chubby Cox chat up lines be?
I don't want to go there. I don't want to go there.
My mind has gone too far. And with that rather horrific ending, we're going to conclude this first segment of Sport Spiel. But stick around, because after our little jingle intermission, Will spoke to Beth Bingham, the Welsh hockey international, about earning her caps for her national side and her rather unconventional start in the sport. Stick around, it's a great interview. We'll see you later.
Hello and welcome back to the fourth episode of Sportsbuilt, where once again it is time for our feature interview. This week we are lucky enough to be joined by Wales hockey international Beth Bingham. Welcome to the show, Beth, and thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Will.
So, quickly, for those of you who don't know, Beth won her 50th international cap for Wales just a couple of weeks ago, a remarkable feat given that she's just 22 years old. She's also a member of the GB Academy setup and was part of the Wales squad that competed at the 2014 Commonwealth Games. But first of all, we'll come back to all that amazing stuff later. I'd just like to ask you, going all the way back to the start of your hockey career, how did you get into the sport in the first place?
Well, basically, when I was younger, I played quite a lot of sports, so, you know, the usual, the netball, football, rounders, that kind of thing. I played quite a high level of table tennis when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
I also did sort of lifeguards training, and one of the mums actually approached me and asked if I would attend a hockey training session the following evening with her daughter. And I wasn't very keen to go. I wasn't really bothered about hockey, didn't know anything about it. But to be polite, I said I'd go. And that first session, I just kind of fell in love with it as a different sport. It was so different to what I'd done before. And we were just dribbling back and forth in pairs and stuff. And I didn't know why. I just really enjoyed it. So I went back the following week, and yeah, that was the start, really. And ever since, I've been playing.
What were the reasons that you didn't really want to go?
I just didn't really fancy being out there, outdoors in the cold. They train for the winter and stuff for hockey. And it was actually winter time. And I just didn't really want to go outside and get cold and wet. I wanted to stay indoors in the pool and stuff. But yeah, like I said, I went, and it just completely changed my opinion of it. And I've loved it ever since.
So was it pretty much straight away, like you said, you fell in love with it and all other sports sort of fell to the wayside? Or did you continue with some of your other sports as well?
Well, yeah, to start with, because I was only, training once a week with Swansea Bay Club, I kept all my other sports going. And then as I got older and older and it started to get a bit more serious, the other sports started to sort of fall at the wayside, so to speak. So I kept on with the lifeguards and kind of tried to balance that with my hockey. And then the decision came whether I had to go down the route to become a proper lifeguard or whether I stuck with hockey. So I decided to stick with hockey.
And you say that you decided to stick with hockey. Sort of, at what age was that you realised that potentially you could make it internationally and that you really wanted to take that on?
So I think I was about 13 years old, and I was really trying to balance the two sports. But it just got to that stage where I was just getting too tired doing both. And it was different sort of training for them, and to be able to sort of get into hockey as much as I wanted to, I had to sort of sacrifice lifeguards. But I think my coach at Swansea kind of said that there was opportunity for Welsh trials coming up for sort of the under-16 setup, and I thought that was something that I really want to do. A few of the older girls are in the setup, and they said how much they enjoyed it. So I think that was my decision there, that I had this opportunity to get into under-16 squad. So I kind of made my decision there and then that hockey would be the one for me.
And did you get into the Welsh setup straight away after that, or did it take a little bit of time?
So I got into sort of the final squad when I was 13. So I was a year young. So I got in, but I wasn't selected for any matches. So that was quite hard, but I was just quite pleased, to be honest, to actually be in the squad. And then from there on, then I sort of made my way up through under 16s, under 18s, and now into the seniors.
And you say it was quite hard not being selected for any games. Did you ever think, or maybe it's not going to happen, or did you think it's going to come, I just need to bide my time?
I think initially I was so disappointed. I think at that age you do just want to be selected for everything sort of straight away. But I think my parents kind of put into perspective for me that, I was young. I had so many more years to get into the school, into the actual team, be selected for games. So I think at first I was kind of like, oh God, that's it. But I persisted, I kept on, and in the following year I did get picked. But I think a lot of people at that age are probably thinking just because they're not selected that's kind of the end of the road, but it's absolutely not. They've got so many more years to get into things.
And then you came through the under-16s and the under-18s, and you made your debut in 2014 or 2013?
2014, yeah, that's correct.
And how did that feel for you? How was it making your international debut?
Yeah, it was quite an incredible game. I won't tell you what the score was. We did lose. It was to Scotland, unfortunately. But I'd been in the senior program since 2012, so it kind of felt like a long time coming. Really, 2 years. I'd been training all the time with the seniors, and I hadn't been picked for any games yet. And then I finally got that selection in 2014, which was a big year of the Commonwealth Games coming up as well. So I knew I had to try and impress the coach then to get selected for further test series and competitions and stuff. So it was incredible to actually go out there, sing the anthem, and get my proper first senior cap. And the rest of the team were so supportive, and they celebrate you getting that first cap. It is quite a big achievement to get. But yeah, I know, even though we didn't win it, didn't go our way, I really thoroughly enjoyed it.
And then later on in 2014, you were selected and you played for Wales at the Commonwealth Games. How wonderful experience of that was that for you?
Yeah, absolutely amazing. It was just an incredible experience. I've never played in front of a crowd that big before with the TV cameras and stuff. It was just incredible. I think it could have been quite a distracting thing, but as soon as you went onto that pitch, the whole team sort of switched on, and I think we did ourselves proud. It was tough going up against these teams that are full time, they're fully funded. It's their professional job really, is playing hockey, and most of us are students, or we just play on the weekends or whatever. We have full time jobs, so it was the best experience ever, and I'd love to do it again.
Was there, you've obviously played a few international games, but was there a step up in the standard in terms of how tough some of the opposition were at a big tournament like that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's the first time that I played Australia, and it was quite an eye-opening experience to see how these guys can just go out onto the pitch for 70 minutes and just be so relentless in the way that they play and how they train and stuff. But I think that just made us, well, especially for me, it just made me really want to try to become as good as I can be, to play for Wales and to be able to compete against these other teams that are doing so well. And I think we've proved in recent games that we are sort of stepping up, not quite to that level yet, but we are making our way as much as we can with the resources we have and that kind of thing, that we are, you know, these teams, they're professional, they're full-time, we're just doing the best that we can to compete, to be honest.
And you made mention there of the fact that you are improving, and that was highlighted in the recent series against Scotland, where you got your first win over them in something like 10 years. That must have been a pretty cool feeling.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we were happy to get the series win despite not playing our best. It wasn't our best performance, but I think it does, like you said, it reflects how much we've improved over the past 12 months, certainly. And we just keep making gains on and off the pitch, and everyone's really committed to this programme. And although, like I said, we're not full-time, what we do away from the pitch when we're on our own, it really makes a difference when we all come together again.
And I noticed on the subject of not being full-time, a tweet from one of your teammates, Lee Wilkinson, just emphasising, you know, how much you continue to defy the odds. There seems to be a really strong team ethos in that Wales squad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've kind of we've come to terms that we've tried to get rid of the whole underdog label, and you know, City as a squad now, we have this belief that we can really compete, and it doesn't matter what resources we have or do not have. We just make the most of what we do have, and the short amount of contact time that we have together, we make the most out of it. We try to squeeze in as much training and meetings and stuff, and ever make sure that they're doing their gym programs and then running when they're away from the training camps. And yeah, it's frustrating that we don't have the funding like other teams, but like I said, we just get on with it. We've come to terms with that now. We can't make excuses. We just have to do our best.
And not only was it a series win, but it was also the series came, and you had your 50th cap in the series. That must have been a very, very special day.
Yeah, it was great, and it was actually the same pitch that I got my first cap. So to be able to get that there, and my dad came to watch, and mum was unfortunately not able to make it, but dad was there with the camera, and it was nice. I had a little presentation in the morning, and we get our flowers and stuff when we get our 50th cap. So it was it was a really nice day, and to top it off with a win was just incredible. So that was in the first game, and then fellow teammate Tina Evans received her 100th cap in the final game of the series, and to get a win for Tina was great. To see someone getting 100 caps, that's where I want to be in the next few years or so. And it's just incredible. It's just great to be able to represent Wales.
And to make that series even more special, your first victory, your first over Scotland in 10 years, actually got a feature on the BBC Sport website as well.
Yeah.
That shows just how much more of a dominant sport hockey is becoming across the British Isles.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I was younger, I never saw hockey at all on TV or in the news or anything. So it was quite hard for me to have sort of role models and stuff, I think. But yeah, it's great that we're getting the sort of coverage now. And it really does put hockey on the map, especially since the GB girls did so well at Rio and they had their bronze medal in London. I think that the more people that get into it and get to see what's happening, they get to see these sort of female role models, it's certainly... it just makes people take it up a lot more.
And you were speaking there about role models. So did you not really have any any major influences when you were growing up and playing hockey?
Not in terms of from the media or anything, because like I said, there was nothing, there's no hockey on TV whatsoever. I'd say my biggest influences were just at training, seeing the older girls. I think they would go over the other side of the pitch and train with the boys because they were, you know, that much better than us. I think I always strived to sort of be like them in terms of being able to, you know, be as athletic as they were and being able to play to the standard that they were. So they were my sort of my role models, so to speak, when I was younger.
And have you been lucky enough to play with any of those girls as well then?
Yeah, so when I got into the under-18s, I was a year young as well, and they were at the, you know, the higher age group for that. So I was able to play with them at Europeans, excuse me, which is pretty cool, yeah.
And then you've got the Euros coming up this summer. How are you and the squad feeling ahead of that?
Yeah, so we haven't actually discussed what our aims for Euros are yet, but I honestly think that we can do really well. As you said, it's a home Europeans. So I think we'll be going there. I certainly think we can go and get a really good result, and we'll be fighting for promotion. We've beaten some of the teams before and lost to some of the teams before that we'll be coming up against in our group, and certainly in the later sort of crossover matches. I think in front of a home crowd, like the last 12 months, we've been proving so much. I think we can go out there and do a proper job.
And then looking forward, next year is the next round of the Commonwealth Games. Am I right in thinking you guys have still got a chance of qualification?
Yeah, I believe so. So it's the top 10 in the Commonwealth that actually qualify. Mm-hmm. So I think after Euros, we'll be waiting to hear if we have qualified or not.
And that, again, that must be something you and the girls are really pushing for, and you want to go out to Australia and play there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the biggest thing for us at the moment is training in preparation for Euros. I think once Euros is done with, and, you know, we find out if we have qualified or not, our attention will switch towards the Gold Coast. And again, we'll take it all in our stride and we'll train just as we have done. I'm sure we'll have a lot more contact. We'll find a way to be able to you know, play alongside each other a lot more, because it'll be, it's such a big tournament, and we have to have the contact time and the hours. But again, you know, we'll come to that when we face it.
And another mention, you've got a couple of Welsh girls now in the full-time GB setup. Again, that must be further proof that this squad is really, really improving, and that you've got so many good players coming through.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the 2012 Olympics, we only had one Welsh woman in the team, so Sarah Thomas, and now we've got two. We've got Sarah Jones and Rose Thomas, who are both involved in the centralised programme at Bisham. And you know, they've been playing well, and they're very much involved in the training there, and they're really enjoying it. And it's just so great to see that you know, we've got Welsh people sort of finding through into the GB system, because it's great for us. They come back to our training sessions, and you know, they bring back that experience of being with, you know, gold medalists and such. And you know, it's good for their training, and it's good for us as well. So it's very nice to see.
And you yourself, you've been part of the GB Academy setup, and still am, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
And you're only 22. Tokyo's a few years away, but then after that, there's a very good chance you could be selected. Is that something you ultimately want to achieve, to be in that centralised programme?
I think definitely. You know, a few years down the line, I'm in the GB development stuff now, and we've had a few matches recently. We played Surbiton a couple of weeks ago, and it went really well. I think towards the future is definitely something that I'd like to aim for. But again, it's that dedication and the training that goes towards it. But yeah, I definitely think it's something I would like to do.
And as well as yourself, are there any players that maybe in that academy setup that we might not have heard that we should be on the lookout for, that you believe could be one of the stars of the future for Great Britain?
There's certainly quite a few English girls in there that that train really well, and I think they did actually go to trials and didn't quite make it. So I think, you know, I won't be able to single anyone out, but you know, there's you know, a whole starting 11 that, you know, could be in the next few years making their way into that centralised programme, and that's great because it's so competitive, and you really have to, you know, step up to the plate when you're at these training camps to kind of get yourself seen and shown, and show that, you know, you deserve to be in that programme as well.
And we're going to go back to you now. You've had a fantastic year both with Wales, but you also had a good year personally at club level as well. So you were named in the Conference North Team of the Season, and Loughborough had a good year, and you got to the Bucks final against Birmingham. How would you describe the club year that you've had?
So I've, This year was definitely my best year at club. Basically, the last few years I was a bit ill, so my season was kind of on and off. I haven't had a full season, but this year I managed to, and to be captain as well at Loughborough's, it was quite a big honour. We didn't start the season very well, so by Christmas we were not where we wanted to be. We had a big chat about it. We spoke to the freshers to try and sort them out a little bit. And then post-January, we were just on it. We didn't concede a goal in Bucks for a long time. As you said, we made Bucks final against Birmingham, who again, are a fantastic team. They had, you know, the gold medalist, Lily Owsley, playing for them. She scored a fantastic goal against us. And they went on to win, which was a shame. But going back to Loughborough, it's such a great university. And to be able to play there this season and to get voted into Team of the Year, I don't think there's a bigger compliment really, and it was one of the best ways to finish off my time there.
And you say you finished off your time, but you've also had to fit in university studies with playing and your degree. How tough has that been?
Yeah, well, it's very tough. It's not an easy thing to do, but like I said, Loughborough is such a good uni and they're very supportive of their student athletes. But I think the biggest thing for me was just being organised. I knew when I had to train, I knew when I needed to be in the library or go into lectures or whatever. And like I said, with injury and illness and stuff, it was a bit of a challenge with exams. I've had to move some around. But again, they are very supportive of that at the uni. I think it helped that, you know, I did sport and exercise science, and it's something I'm very interested in. And, you know, the lectures on nutrition and the psychology, it all sort of fits around into my sport. So it kind of made it a bit easier, I suppose, to sort of engage with the course. Which is really, and it has helped me out in my sport as well, because I've been able to sort of, you know, do the reading stuff and, you know, make gains off the field in terms of nutrition and stuff like that.
That actually leads on really nicely to my next question. I was going to ask, are there any elements of your degree that you've really sort of taken in to help your game?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I mentioned, the nutrition side of it and the psychology side, it's all very interesting. And, you know, I get to pick my modules for my final year, which I'm in now. And I kind of went down the route of the physiology, the nutrition side of it, and the stuff that we get told at training camps from our S&C coach, I can relate to, because I know the science, the scientific base behind it, and I know why we're doing certain things, why we're, you know, running all these reps with, you know, short break in between and stuff like that. And I think just, you know, being able to know that kind of stuff helps me to actually want to go out on the pitch and do it.
And are these things that you've then taken back to either your teammates at Loughborough or your teammates at Wales and used with them as well?
I think I quite annoy some of my team as I do with my little facts of the day and stuff. And, you know, when we're having lunch and stuff, I'll kind of point out different things, which is quite funny. I think they get, you know, they get a bit annoyed about. But, I find it really interesting. So I do try and take some of that stuff back to training with me.
And as you've already said, this is your final year at Loughborough. What happens now? Is it full-time hockey, or are you going to have to go and find another job? And whereabouts are you going to be living and all that sort of thing?
Well, I'm hoping to join a Premiership team next season. Obviously, leading into hopefully the Commonwealth Games next year, I need to be playing at, you know, the highest level possible in England. I think it'll just be because of the training schedule we'll have. I think it'll just be a case of finding sort of coaching jobs where I can, certainly for next year, and then it'll be looking for a full-time job then the following year, because it's so hard to go straight into a full-time job now to fit it around the training and stuff. So I think for next year it'll just be little jobs here and there, to be honest.
And this might be quite a cheeky question, which you're not allowed to answer, but do you know if there are any clubs that are interested in your services for next year?
I think I'm pretty set on joining Holcombe. I've discussed with Kevin, who he's actually our Welsh coach as well, and he is Holcombe's coach. I think that'll be the place that I head to next season.
And that's obviously down in Kent. Is that an area you've been to or spent much time in before?
No, not at all. But I have friends nearby, and they said they'd, you know, show me around and take me out a little bit. So I'm sure I'll be able to fit in.
And final few questions. The first of all, you're only 22, as I've said, but you've had a fantastic career, especially in the last few years. But are there any moments that really, really stand out for you that from what you've experienced so far?
Well, I think most people probably expect me to say the Commonwealth Games, which obviously was such a fantastic experience, and you know, I've never been at anything like that before. But I think most recently it was actually gaining my 50th cap. It kind of put into perspective for me, you know, the sort of things that you get for training so hard for the last few years, and to be able to get it, you know, when I'm 22 years old, I think it's such a great achievement. And it was just nice to be out on the pitch again with the girls and for them to celebrate with it with me. I think that's one of my standout moments of my career so far.
And what may be the biggest challenge that you've had to face?
So last year I was quite ill about a 2 year period, really, on and off. And I really struggled to get back into hockey, and I was obviously really unfit. And I kind of thought it might have been the end of my playing career. So that was one of the biggest challenges, of sort of sorting my head out mentally to be able to get back into playing, coming back from injury and illness. It's a very hard thing to do, especially when everyone around you is playing and enjoying it. But I got over that. It took a while, but I got back into my hockey and training and stuff. And now I'm just loving it again, but that was a very big challenge for me.
And final question, we'll fast forward 15 years into the future. So you're 37 years old.
Yeah.
By that age, what would you like to have achieved in the sport?
I think I'll be retired by then. but hopefully I'll have a few more Commonwealth Games under my belt. I certainly hope to have represented GB at some sort of level by then, but who knows what the future holds. But, it's up to me now to train and really strive to be able to achieve those things. It won't be easy, but hopefully in 15 years' time we'll look back and say that I made it.
Well, that's all I have for you, Beth. Thank you very much for your time, especially considering you've been in the middle of exams. And, yeah, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you for talking to me.
Well, thanks again to Beth for taking part in that interview with Will. A lot of interesting things came up in conversation there. Now, we're about to finish off, and we'll put a timely reminder to everyone to take part in our embarrassing names poll.
Yep, as usual, we'll be putting it up on Twitter, as we said. So you've got the choice of Gaylord Tilly, Fanny Schmeller, Chubby Cox, or other. So let us know what you think. Like, retweet, make sure you vote. Again, we'll do it for about a week this time. We did quite well last time, 20-odd votes. We found out that Liverpool, for once, hadn't slipped up and were deemed to be the biggest chokers in sport.
At least they won something.
At least they won something. Thanks. Feel free to take part and follow us on social media. We'll try and be a bit more active and do a few more things. And I hope, just enjoy listening, tell your friends.
Yes, fire away, social media, we're there at Sportsfield Pod on Twitter, we're on Facebook, we're on Instagram, and of course you can email us things that you like or dislike about the podcast, or the two of us, at sportsfieldpod@gmail.com. We're going to be back next week, so we're going to be back on our regular schedule for episode 5. We'll see you in a week's time. Bye-bye.